Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson. Here's the question. Have the equity markets topped? Now, I know that question's on everyone's mind, but the real action, as always, is in the bond market, where we might ask the very same question. Has the bond market topped? As I have been fond of writing and saying recently, if you loved rising equities coupled with falling yields, you're probably going to hate the opposite. And there are a lot of reasons, fundamental, technical, and related to market sentiment, to suspect that the fun ride of ever higher equity and bond prices is over, at least for a while. Today, I'm pleased to be speaking again with some of the team at New Harbor Financial. That's Mike Preston and John Lodra, who will help us understand today how a disciplined approach to investing can make all the difference when markets wander into extreme territory. Now, before we get started, I'll make it clear that Peak Prosperity has a commercial relationship with New Harbor Financial, one in which fees are shared on referred accounts. It's important to note that this arrangement does not result in any increased fees charged to the end customer. You're charged the same as if you walked in through the front door. All the details on this arrangement are provided clearly in writing during the referral process if we get to that point. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you for having us today, Chris.
Hi, thank you, Chris.
Great. So, let's start at the outside. I love starting from the outside in. Fed policy, and I guess everything's hinging on Fed policy. Certainly the Fed governors or chairmen or people open their mouths and the markets swoon or gyrate or up and down, all of that. But really, what the Fed's trying to do is prop up all the prices of financial assets, including real estate if it can, to create this wealth effect. And from where I'm sitting, it looks like, you know, what are we, 6 years into this experiment? There's not a whole slew of really convincing data that the Fed's been really successful. Tell me how this macro view, how you see this world today.
Chris, this is John. I'll be happy to kick us off with that that topic. You know, so the Fed's done a lot of talking about their objective to jumpstart the economy through job growth and GDP growth and whatnot. Really, from our perspective, it's been a very thinly veiled guise for incenting folks to flood into risk-based financial assets. You know, in effect, and we don't want to beat this to death because I think, you know, we actually have a game here in our office. Once in a while, we'll turn on CNBC and see how long we can get before someone mentions the Fed, usually in a bullish, positive light. We actually think the Fed has done tremendous harm, potentially tremendous harm to the function of financial markets. And it really comes down to the fact that they have become such a huge factor in, frankly, one of the largest markets in the world, the bond markets, the U.S. Treasury and mortgage-backed bond markets, and have had the effect through both their purchases of bonds and their 0% interest rate policies of driving interest rates down and prices up on bonds over these last several years, such that the forward return has been, you know, assumed to be quite pitiful for most investors. So what that has caused is folks to essentially flood into other risk-based assets like stocks, like high-yield or junk bonds, like real estate, and, you know, basically, you know, get bullied out of, you know, safer assets that many folks believe they should be in. You know, we think there's been a huge amount of artificiality priced into markets like the bond markets, and consequently, we feel that almost on a mirror image kind of way, there's been a huge amount of artificiality priced into things like the stock market. If you think about, you know, markets in equilibrium, folks are going to flood from one asset class to another when the return prospects are greater in the asset in those other asset classes. So if you essentially have cash earning zero, well, in a macro sense, the Fed's policies have caused folks to flee into other asset classes such that their essentially risk-adjusted return prospects have also been driven to zero. So almost uniformly, we feel that most, if not all, asset classes have been driven to essentially, you know, zero or near zero prospective returns from this point in time.
So here we are with poor returns, at least on a risk-adjusted basis. And looking at the market action recently, we've seen both equities falling and bond prices falling at the same time. And you know, no real action in the dollar to sort of support or explain those moves. So they seem real. And so the question becomes, Have the markets topped, and where are we in this cycle? Because this is, we're pretty long in the tooth in this particular bull market advance. And what are your views there? Have we? Is it time to become more defensive than usual, or is this time to become really defensive?
Chris, this is Mike. I'll take a shot at that one. You'd be hard pressed to find a money manager that will actually have the credit to go out and say the market has topped. Frankly, we thought the market was risky a year ago, and it kept grinding higher day after day, month after month. We do think the market is at or near a top, you know, as we sit here in August of 2013, mid-August. Market went up to around 1707 on the S&P. Presently, it's right around 1655. The market probably has put in a top at that level. Of course, no one can guarantee that to be the case. Even if the market, though, goes higher than its previous high at 1700 or so, it's unlikely that these gains will be durable. It's unlikely that these gains will be able to be kept by most people, and that's really the point. We as money managers want to take risk when risk is likely to be appropriately rewarded by durable gains over the long term. And when I say long term, I mean over a period of several years, a full market cycle, if you will. And so when answering that question, we really have to build a case. And the case that we're trying to build is, should we be bullish or should we be bearish? Is this a time to take a lot of risk, even leverage risk, to, you know, going long stocks, or that is betting that stocks are going to go up? Or should we be pulling back or paring back our risk by moving more and more into cash? So in building that case, really we have to take a look at a lot of different sets of data. And there's really good people out there putting together really good data. It's not hard to find from your site to some other sources that we're going to give due credit to here in just a minute. The bearish case has a lot of data available that you can look at the hard and fast numbers and say, geez, you know, things aren't as rosy as CNBC would like us to believe. On the flip side, the bullish argument is hard to find concrete data to back up the markets going higher from here. So really what I'd like to do is just spend 1 minute or so defining stock market, secular stock market cycles. When I say secular market cycles, I'm talking about 10 to 20 years in length. And you know, here there's a good source called Crestmont Research. It's put together by a man named Ed Easterling. It's crestmontresearch.com. There's lots of neat charts and graphs on there, but there's a number that we use and we find useful. And he puts together a nice graph showing secular stock market cycles over a long period of time. And you can see by looking back over the last 100 years or so that stock markets alternate between bull markets, that is markets going up, and bear markets, that is markets going sideways to down. And they alternate every 10 or 20 years. So really between 1900 and 1920 was a bear market, only ended after World War One. 1920 to 29 was a large bull market, and 29 to 45 was a 16-year bear market. And you know, 1945 all the way up to 1966 was a wonderful bull market, where the 50s actually showed a gain greater in the stock market than the 90s showed. 1966 to 1982 was a secular sideways bear market, and 1982 to 2000 was once again a bull market. So it's kind of an on-off type thing. And between 2000 and now, 2013, we've been in a secular bear market. So the question on the table here is, are we at the end of a secular bear market? I mean, the S&P has gone nowhere, literally, in almost 14 years, with two declines of 50% along the way. So the real question is, are we about to break out into a brand new secular bull market here? Or are we simply midway or more along the path of a secular bear market, one that could have declines of 40 to 60 or even 70% lying ahead? We think for a lot of different reasons we're still in a secular bear. A lot of folks out there are saying the opposite. CNBC and the financial press think the secular bear market is over. We've heard people say this is like a 1982 type moment, that the secular bull is back, and we don't think it is.
Well, let's talk about some of those fundamental factors that really will support the defensive view in this particular point in time. You know, I will say that the one piece of evidence I've heard on the bullish side is goes something like this: the Fed won't allow the stock market to go down, which is shorthand for saying that the Fed stands ready to print as much as necessary to keep prices elevated. But that's not a really fundamental value sort of a play to speculate on whether the Fed's going to dump more money in or not. Let's talk about those fundamental factors for a minute. So what do we have? Talk about, like, earnings come up all the time. Corporate earnings are at all-time highs, and there's projections that they're going to go even higher.
Chris, this is John. I'll take the handoff there. So if you look at these cycles that Mike referred to, there are very clear signposts that one can look back at and say, you know, these were glaring indicators that told us we were in the neighborhood of the end or the beginning of a given bear or bull cycle. And some of the most reliable signposts that one can look at are valuations, okay? How expensive as a function of earnings are stocks, individual stocks, or the market in general, and also things like interest rate or inflation trends. So let's hit each of those in turn. So, you know, one of the most common, you know, metrics that folks will toss out in terms of measuring the valuation of the market is the so-called P-E ratio, price-to-earnings ratio. Pretty simple concept. The numerator in that fraction is the price of a stock or a price of the stock market in general, like the S&P 500. And the denominator, the E, is the earnings of that company or the market in general. So, sounds simple enough, but the devil is in the detail. The E, the numerator, is where most of the mischief happens. Mm-hmm. You know, if you put an E under there, an earnings that is misleading or artificially high, you're going to come up with a P-E ratio that is misleadingly low, leading one to conclude that, hey, the market's undervalued, you know, the market has room to go up from here. And that's really where much of the mischief has happened of late. If you look at corporate earnings right now, it's somewhat of a conundrum to most folks, but they're at very much peak levels. If you look at over a long period of time, clear as day, corporate earnings have risen over time. That's why the stock market has, you know, risen over the last century plus with very strong results. But just as certain as that long-term rising trend has been a pretty defined and cyclical pattern, peaks and troughs around that trend line, we happen to be right now in an area that is on what one would call a peak of that cycle. So if you use a peak, you know, most analysts will use a single year of earnings estimates, usually Wall Street's forward operating estimates that are generally high and biased to the high side. If you use a peak number in that denominator, you're going to come up with a much lower P/E ratio than is reality. Professor Robert Shiller of Yale came up with a pretty simple but novel way to adjust for that, so-called Shiller-adjusted P/E ratio, which looks at the prior 10 years and averages those and adjusts them for inflation. And when you do that, you smooth out the unintended effects of that cyclicality to earnings. So if you look at where the Shiller-adjusted P/E ratio has been in these major bull and bear market cycles in history, you know, basically, true durable bull markets start with a P/E ratio, a Shiller-adjusted P/E ratio in the 5 to 10 range, okay? And they typically end, and a new bear market begins when the Shiller-adjusted P/E ratio reaches 20 to 25 in that ballpark. Right now, we're between 24 and 25 on the Shiller-adjusted P/E ratio. So on valuations that are, you know, have been a very clear indicator of major market bottoms and tops, we are about as extreme on evaluation as we've ever been, with the exception being, you know, the tech bubble in 2000, where Shiller-adjusted PEs got up to about 46. Now, not too many folks are willing to say that was logical or will ever be repeated again. And so we're on evaluation standpoint, we're very much on the high end of history usually coincides with the beginning of a new bear market rather than a new bull market. We can talk about things like interest rates and inflation. You know, just quickly, inflation, you know, right now we have somewhat moderate, stable inflation. In fact, that's much to the Fed's frustration. They want to stimulate a little more inflation than they're getting. But history has shown that when you move from a period of stable inflation to either high inflation or low inflation, meaning deflation, that has tended to be a horrible time for the stock market. So either way, you know, the Fed seems to be, you know, worried about two scenarios here, deflation and longer-term inflation. Either of those moves has traditionally been associated with, you know, very horrible results in the stock market.
All right. And so in there, you mentioned something else, which is the interest rate trends. And that's certainly something that's caught my attention a lot lately, because you want to talk about things the Fed wants and doesn't want. The interest rate trend, which has been worldwide, watching the long-term interest rates, those 10-year bonds and higher, a bunch of sovereign nations have really risen a lot since, depending on which country we're talking about. It was early May to early June. And so it's been a couple of months. It's a fairly durable phenomenon, at least in, by recent standards. And it's gone so far that people like PIMCO have tweeted out that, that's it. You know, we hit a long-term secular low in interest rates. And what was that, maybe 1.6 on the 10-year? It was somewhere in that zone. And that's it. So they're just heading up from here. Talk about the relationship of interest rates and stocks, or equities in this case.
Sure. I'll offer a quick response to that, Chris. Yeah, the 10-year note, the world watches the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury bond. It really drives the interest rates on so many very important vehicles, not the least of which is home mortgages. So last year, in roughly August of last year, the 10-year bond yield bottomed out at 1.39, about 1.4%. And most recently, as I look at it right now, it's at 2.8%. So that's an increase. It's really almost a doubling, actually, if you look at it that way. It really literally is a doubling from about 1.4 to 2.8, or put another way, an increase of 1.4%. This has had the effect of driving mortgage rates up over a point. Average mortgage rates now are up around 4.6. They were in the mid-threes not too long ago, maybe about 6 months ago. So as interest rates rise, it essentially is toxic for the economy and the stock market, because business owners and consumers are less likely to borrow and reinvest. Homeowners are less likely to borrow and build that addition or move to a bigger home. Companies are less likely to borrow and, you know, finance the purchase of other companies, or even investing in new plant and equipment. So this is something that everyone's watching. It's something that we're watching closely, and frankly, it's one of the hostile syndromes that John Hussman, another person that we admire and read quite closely, he has a site, HussmanFunds.com, H-U-S-S-M-A-N. He talks about a toxic syndrome or a dangerous syndrome in the stock market, and one of those is interest rates rising quickly over the past six-month period. That's exactly what we're seeing. So this is a huge warning flag, and you're right. Bill Gross tweeted, he's the other day he said, we've got no one to sell to but ourselves. All assets are inflated. So certainly it's got us very, very cautious and very defensive.
Chris, just adding to that quick, you know, so many of the fairly, you know, kind of unsupported bullish arguments have been, well, because bonds are yielding so little, stocks represent the best game in town. You know, so now that interest rates have ticked up, still modestly but significantly relative to where they were, that argument starts to lose some weight. And in fact, you know, looking at where the 10-year bond is right now, just a tad bit under 2.9%, you know, if you look at some work done by folks like John Hussman that Mike just mentioned, and GMO, a big money manager based out of Boston, who both have very good, reliable track records in projecting prospective returns in the stock markets, you know, John Hussman estimates that 10-year forward returns in the S&P 500 are roughly right in line with that 2.9% that 10-year bonds are currently priced to yield. GMO, actually, for the 7-year horizon, actually projects a negative return for most stocks. So all of a sudden, the even modest pickup in yields on bond really challenges the prospective return prospects for things like stocks. So they're no longer the slam dunk best show in town relative to artificially low bond yields.
Well, and we saw that virtuous cycle on the way down in yields, where, you know, the lower yields went, the more attractive stocks became. And so really that was a plus, with all the ample liquidity provided by the Fed et al. You had a really virtuous cycle where both bonds and stocks went up. And of course, that was on the Fed game plan and other central banks. And so here we have the opposite, where we're seeing on some of these days red in stocks and red in bonds at the same time. So there's all this selling going on. And that clearly says something about market conditions and whether there's a enough liquidity to be supplied, really, to keep everything elevated where it is. And potentially the answer is no at this point. Now, one of the things that I think the Fed has been counting on is this idea of this wealth effect that we started out this podcast with, and this idea that the stock market, it's the same thing as the economy, right? You know, as long as equities are rising, I guess the tail will wag the dog and the economy will follow along. Do you take exception with that?
Well, this is John again, Chris. You know, your recent piece of a couple days ago, I think very eloquently spoke to it. If you look at the where the rubber meets the road with the jobs recovery, look at GDP growth, you know, it's clear that after, you know, 5-6 years of intervention here, the results that were so much sought and promised are not being delivered. You know, we're having pathetic rebounds in job recoveries and GDP growth. So I think the evidence speaks for itself. The reality is that most folks forget that the stock market is a forward-looking machine, if you will. The stock market, let's not forget, the stock market began rallying back in 2009. We've had a pretty long rally here, and for folks to now be saying, well, if the economy starts to get better, that means the stock market will go higher, a lot of that possible future improvement is already more than priced into the gains in the stock market over the last several years since the 2009 low. And most folks fail to realize that the stock market usually rebounds when economic news is getting worse, not when it's getting better. And we think that story is more than played out to an excessive level, and that even with improvements in the economy, we're likely to see a major pullback in the stock market.
Well, buy the rumor, sell the news is a operative phrase that I learned to trade by, meaning that the stock market is there projecting that the economy is going to recover, and then when it finally does, it's already priced that all in. It's already bought that rumor, and the news itself may or may not be what you're hoping for. And if the Shiller adjusted PEs are right, boy, if you want, unless you're expecting us to go back to 2000 levels on the NASDAQ and get to price earnings that are in the 40s and 50s, that's where you're going to get a market doubling. Otherwise, we're going to have the earnings really double. And of course, they're at not just highs, but at levels that have really never been recorded before on a percentage base of the economy. So all of this hinges, all of the euphoria around the fundamental side on the bull case hinges on the economy really taking off. And each successive GDP release is, 1%, 1.5%, this is not taking off. So that part isn't happening. Well, those fundamental reasons, I think, are that's one thing you guys are looking at. Sentiment is something I used to track when I was trading. Tell us how you track sentiment and what you're seeing there.
Chris, this is Mike. Sentiment is really overwhelmingly bullish across the board, and there's a number of different ways to track it. No really exact science. There's a number of polls out there like National Association of Investment Managers and the AAII poll. A number of these and more polls of investment managers are showing really record complacency, really record lows in the number of bears. And when I say lows in the number of bears, I'm talking about people that think the stock market will go down. The respondents of the people that think the stock market will go down are less than 30%, just to throw out an average number. So there's really a dearth of pessimism, and really stock markets take off and launch into their multi-year secular bull markets amid in social environments that are awash in pessimism. They don't take off to new secular bull markets when everyone is bubbly with optimism. And right now, people are bubbly with optimism. There really isn't that many people that are negative or paying attention to the data that should make them be negative on the stock market. So investment managers, you can just take a poll of them, and again, there's a lot of different data that you can look at there. Simple things, even just like magazine covers, for instance. Magazine covers in April 22nd, Barron's cover, there was a bull jumping on a pogo stick. He had jumped right over a bear who was cowering in the background, and it said Dow 16,000 on the cover. And there's been a lot of these types of magazine covers lately, and this is not an environment that you want to see, really, if you're a bull. You really want to see negative covers. So generally, when you've got magazine covers that are so positive, you have a social mood, and that's really what we're concerned with, is social mood. You've got a social mood that's reached a peak in terms of optimism. When social mood changes and then reaches the realization phase that maybe things aren't as great as they thought they were, that's when you get very fast, very vertical elevator type drops to the downside that are unexpected. So that's what we're concerned about.
One of the things I track, Mike, was also looking at the New York Stock Exchange level of margin. So margin meaning people, investment managers, others have gone out and borrowed money in order to go long or invest in stocks. From my point of view, you want, by the time people have already borrowed to go long on stocks, they've probably done all they can do, or they don't have much further to go in that run. What are you tracking that as well?
Yes, margin debt is very near record levels, at or above where we were in 2000 and 2007. it's not enough for many speculators to be 100% invested. They want to be 200% invested, betting on the stock market going up or more. That's generally a terrible time to be investing for the long term. A number of other things, I'll just kind of go through some other things that we're looking at. Insider selling, talking about corporate insiders. They're selling almost 10 shares, at 9.2 shares at last check. They're selling for every one that they're buying of their own company's stock. And there are reasons that corporate insiders sell, of course. They might just need the money for something else. But when you get almost a 10-to-1 sell-to-buy ratio, it's something to really pay attention to. Interestingly, there's one sector of the stock market that's nearly the opposite of that, and that is gold and silver miners. They are corporate insiders at gold and silver mining companies are buying 10 shares for every one that they're selling. So that's pretty interesting. In light of a gold and silver mining sector that at its worst was down almost 70% year-to-date this year. It was just a brutal bear market for that group. But those insiders are doing the smart thing, at least in their eyes, and buying stock. And really, this time is different, as John, I think, mentioned earlier in the conversation. Everyone thinks this time is different. You know, they say the Fed's got our back. This is probably going to go down as being called the Fed bubble or the Bernanke bubble, very similar to the housing bubble 2006 and the tech bubble of 2000. Just quickly, there's other things. Stock market, stock equity mutual funds have record low cash, down to about 3% of holdings. Typically, they hold 5 or 6%, but last couple months have been down around 3%. There's been record retail inflows of cash into equity mutual funds over the last couple months as well. So, and you couple that with everything else we're talking about, valuation and so forth, it paints a really disturbing picture. One last thing I might mention is the volatility. The volatility of this market has been very low. The volatility is measured by something called VIX, V-I-X. Recently, that went under 12, which was right near a multi-year low, and it just shows how much complacency there is. This market doesn't move a lot day to day, and sometimes it's like watching paint dry, but it's that exact type of market that sometimes is the most dangerous because it just kind of lulls people to sleep. And in the midst of the hostile environment that we're in, it has us a great deal in cash and just kind of sitting on our hands and waiting for better opportunity.
All right, well, let's talk about if we peel back the covers on equities for the moment, you peer in there and look at what's going on. You mentioned what happens when you look into insider selling. If you peer under the covers and note that in gold and silver miners, for some reason, they're buying 10 for every one they're selling. When you peel back the covers, what are you seeing in there technically that might support a bearish versus a bullish case?
Yeah, I'll take over here. This is John again. Much on the sentiment side of things and technical side of things, if you look at the gold and silver miners, they are almost the exact opposite of what's going on in the broader stock market. There has been no more unloved asset class than the gold and silver miners over the last couple quarters. And when you think about markets in general, they operate on the simple laws of supply and demand. Frankly, if there are more people wanting to buy than wanting to sell, the price has got to go up to tease out more sellers. And vice versa, if more people are wanting to sell than people willing to buy, well, the price has got to drop to entice more buyers to come in. If you look at technical and sentiment readings on the gold and silver miners, almost uniquely, they have been in rock bottom levels, rivaling to the negative sentiments that we observed both in that sector and the broad stock market in general back in the depths of the decline in 2009. So frankly, we've just seen lots of signs of an exhaustion of sellers in that sector. And from a technical standpoint, technical analysis really comes down to trend following and momentum strategies that kind of don't ask so much the question of why are things going up or down, but are they? And what are buyers and sellers doing to carry on those trends? And basically, there's been lots of signs that some of the selling pressure has abated in the gold and silver miners, and we've seen at least near term here quite a sizable bounce off the bottom. And almost the opposite is what we're seeing in the broad stock market at this juncture.
Well, what is it that you're seeing in the broad stock market there in terms of the technical factors?
Well, so it's very early. We're not willing to say that the top is today or last week. The topping processes usually take time. But what you start to see in broad topping patterns in the stock market is a lot of different things, but one very hallmark sign is a narrowing of leadership. So if you can almost imagine, You know, obviously, we see the news every day. The S&P 500 did this, or the Dow Jones Industrial Average did that. That talks about the index in general. When you look underneath those indices, though, and look at how individual stocks in those indices are behaving relative to the direction of the index, what you oftentimes find at major tops is that fewer and fewer stocks are going trending higher while the index itself is going higher. So, you know, in very extreme events, you might have a small handful of stocks carrying an index higher at the same time that more and more stocks underlying that index are turning lower. And we're starting to see that in some things. You know, for example, for the last couple of years, there's been record low dispersion between different sectors of the economy in terms of stock market returns. That has basically spoken to the fact that it's been an all risk on or all risk off, you know, mostly all risk on environment for the last few years. But we're starting to see some dispersions. There actually are some sectors that are starting to outperform or underperform other sectors. That is a sign that there's not this uniform bid being placed under all stocks of every stripe. We're starting to see things like the often talked about Hindenburg omen, which we don't, you know, we're not, you know, particularly watchers of that one index, that one indicator. But that speaks to, you know, at the same time, many stocks are making all-time highs. There are also a large number of stocks making, you know, new lows. So it speaks to a dispersion, a faltering of many stocks at the same time that fewer stocks are carrying the market higher. Those are just some of the things. One analogy we like to use in technical analysis is that of a rubber band. The markets generally stretch in either direction like a rubber band would, and they oftentimes overstretch in either direction too much. And over time, things revert back to the mean, meaning the rubber band snaps back to the center point, if you will. If you look at where stock markets have been across the board for the last several months, and in fact even the last couple of years, uniformly they've been very much overbought statistically on the upside, meaning they've stretched the upside far faster than is normal on almost every time horizon, whether you're measuring it on, you know, a short number of weeks or many months. And that is typically signs of a market that is getting towards the tail end of a move higher. It's kind of the last act of desperation before the path of least resistance becomes the sellers wanting to get out for whatever reason.
All of this with $85 billion a month pouring in still. So if we add all this up, you've got some technical factors supporting views, sentiment, and then the fundamental reasons that you think it's time for caution. So, Mike, starting with you, how do you invest in these times? How are you helping to guide people through what you consider to be fairly risky environments where returns might even be negative?
Yeah, at least in the short term, we do think over the next couple of years, returns are likely to be negative in the stock market. It's a very challenging time, Chris, to say the least. Very challenging time for us as money managers to continue to do what we think is the right thing. You really have to avoid the urge to just do something. Everyone wants to do something. They always want their money to be working for them. They want to be in this stock or that bond or this commodity future. Sometimes, especially in an era like now where all assets pretty much have been moving in tandem, and they're all priced off a risk-free rate of 0%, so they're priced to return very poorly at present times because the risk premium has been stripped away from them. You really need to just think about sitting in cash or allocating a good portion of your portfolio to cash. Cash really, truly is king sometimes. It is an investment decision to sit in cash. If you don't have some cash, you're not going to have the ability to buy at better valuations. Most of your long-term success as an investor, and this applies to money managers who have been hired to invest money for people, is going to be dictated by how well you stick to your discipline and where you deploy money and where valuations are at. So you really have to think about patience, and that's the hardest thing to do. We as money managers are sitting on a very large amount of cash in some portfolios, over 50% cash. That's really something that not many money managers like to do. It's not something that many retail investors like to do. But money managers have something called career risk that they're constantly having to make sure that they're staying ahead of or keeping up with the various indices, and they're really afraid to hold on to cash because holding a large cash position is precisely what threatens their livelihood more than anything. Clients don't like to sit with a money manager that's holding cash, and invariably, if you sit on cash, you're going to be early, like we are this year. You're going to be early, and you're going to miss a little bit of a run-up, but it's really the only way that we know to produce above-average returns over the long term. You have to be early. Better to be early than even a little bit late. We've heard you say that often.
Mm-hmm.
So, especially when the market reaches extremes, you have to be preemptive. Because I talked a little bit earlier about the low volatility environment. We're not predicting this is going to happen right away, but we could very well have a sharp drop like we did in October of 1987. And there's no way to get out of the way of something like that unless you're preemptive and hold a large cash position. So we would urge people to really think about holding a core position in cash and waiting to deploy those assets at a better time.
Absolutely. So if we're looking at where the markets are really standing right now, obviously it's timing is a really difficult thing to get exactly right in this business. Of course, it's impossible really to do it more than a couple of times, maybe randomly on a career. So you have to pick your moments, and you do that by assessing the risks such as they stand. And so we've talked about all of the risks that are out there, but somebody listening to this, sitting in cash is one thing they can do. How else do you really go about being defensive in an environment where everything is overpriced?
Chris, I can offer some perspectives on that. You know, there are a lot of different things. Again, cash is one of the cheapest forms of insurance you can find. But there are other tools. You know, for example, we make extensive use of options in our portfolio management. Now, I do have to disclose that options can be fairly risky tools if, you know, not fully understood. And there's a full disclosure document that buddy trading in options needs to sign off as having read. But, you know, basically, you know, things like put and call options can be very effective in helping to mitigate untenable risk. You know, so for example, buying put options is very much similar to buying insurance on your home or auto. You essentially pay a premium in return for some downside or insurance protection. Don't want to get too much into the details there, but it's a way to effectively buy insurance on your financial assets. Selling call options is a way to generate additional income that can serve as a return enhancer in a flat or sideways market, but also can be an important form of downside protection, albeit limited to the amount of the option premium that you take in, but nonetheless downside protection in the event of, you know, move downward in the particular asset that you sold call options against. You know, good old diversification. Now, we believe in diversification, not in the context of most, you know, traditional managers who believe in diversification in the form of having a pie chart with, you know, 30 different slices, you know, held constant through whatever market environment is thrown at them. You know, we believe in diversification in a more tactical sense, you know, that, you know, combining with, you know, some trend following with technical indicators that, you know, can diversify out of currencies to take away the currency risk, can diversify even amongst asset classes. You know, for example, being a bond investor but in the right kinds of bonds is important. You know, if you look at, you know, most bonds have lost money this year, but generally speaking, short-term, high-quality bonds have fared much better than things like long-term municipal bonds or long-term treasury bonds or high-yield corporate bonds. So a lot of, you know, asset allocation in the sense of tactical adjustments given the risk and rewards, but also, you know, selection within sectors based upon the particular set of risks or opportunities that are in play.
Well, let's talk a minute about the asymmetry of risk. If you do suffer a bear market decline, and I know, Mike, you mentioned before that they tend to take back what they gave in the bull market in the first part. It's hard to get your arms around it sometimes as an investor, because a 50% loss, that really hurts. But to make it back, you need 100% gain to get back to even. And it's really difficult to make those gains back, particularly if you look at the analysis of GMO and Jeremy Grantham's work there, where he's talking about the idea that we're facing a long-term structural, maybe even negative real return environment. That's a really difficult place to go out and maybe think about making any sort of returns in. But if what you've just articulated with on the fundamental side is correct, basically people are in the business of lining up for very low returns against a very high risk environment, and where the risks are not symmetrically stacked for you. So if your approach then is to take that risk when you think it's really likely you're going to be durably rewarded, I think is the terms you use there. Tell me how you go about really constructing a portfolio then, or how you think about investing for somebody in this environment.
let me see if I can elaborate a little bit on that. It's it really is all about discipline presently, Chris. I'd like to say that there's some really fancy things that we do, or mm-hmm. that we can pick the right stocks, or we can pick undervalued stocks in an overvalued market, and sometimes that can be done. But by and large, we're picking our spots and being tactical, if you will. Again, holding a large amount of cash is very boring, but something that we think is very important. And the patience here can't be understated. Sometimes you have to wait for the opportunity, and that time that you're waiting might be a year or two or even more. But it really, just kind of building on what you just mentioned about interest rates increasing and becoming more attractive to investors. John was talking earlier about the 10-year note has a yield now of 2.9%. That means if you invest money at today's prices, you're guaranteed, as long as the U.S. government stays solvent, to make 2.9% yield over the next 10 years. And sure, the value of the bonds could fluctuate a little bit over from time to time if you went to sell them before the 10 years is up. But compare that with the S&P 500, which is presently, as John Hussman has calculated, probably is priced to achieve somewhere around 2.8 to 2.9% over the next 10 years, with at least one 40 to 60% drop along the way. So that's really what's so treacherous about right now. The spots that we like are things like we talked about earlier, where we're seeing insider buying, where we're seeing really depressed valuations, gold and silver mining stocks. This is something that even after the most recent bounce, we think there's still compelling value in that sector. Owning some U.S. and even sovereign debt, if very, very short in the maturity, say 3 to 5 years, can add some value. But we like to really limit the doses there. And really, other than that, we're more tactical on pullbacks in the market. I don't really want to say we buy the dip, because I really kind of hate that phrase at this point. We all do. But we might tactically add a little bit of stock market exposure on a 10 or 15% decline and hedge it with options. But, you know, at the risk of being redundant, we really have to hold a lot of cash. And we have been that way for probably 12 to 18 months. We've been between 30 and 60% cash, and that remains.
Well, fantastic discipline that you're showing there. And, of course, it's one of the reasons that we were drawn to working with you gentlemen over there at New Harbor, is because of that discipline. I'm a believer that when markets are insane, you need as much sanity as you can get. That we've got a Federal Reserve that's interventionist. It's trying things that have never been tried before. But much of history suggests that it's never different this time. It's always something that returns to the mean. We are so far above the mean in so many dimensions that a betting person, I feel like we're standing in front of a roulette wheel that's got only three red squares and a bunch of black ones, and you kind of know where you want to have your money placed down on the table at this point in time. So this is all sounds very rational, very sensible. I hope anybody listening to this has enjoyed the conversation. As you heard, there's a lot of depth here, and there's a lot of discipline, and that's why we've chosen to work with the people at New Harbor. Mike Preston, been talking today, and John Lodra, thank you so much for your time, gentlemen. I do appreciate it.
Thank you for having us, Chris, and thanks, folks, for listening.
It's been a pleasure, Chris. Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for listening.
And I hope we get to do it again soon. So long for today. This is Chris Martinson signing off for peakprosperity.com.